My name is Terilyn Lawson.
I'm Claire Joseph Meyer.
And this is That's What She Said, helping us basically whenever we do a podcast. We have Joy Littleton, a student here at the University of Oregon. Say hey.
Hey.
Open up the subject for us.
Oh,
Sister
yes.
Sister Claire, what were we talking about?
So today, we are talking about a couple of different things. The first is that in anticipation of this being the month of Halloween, Terilyn and I wanted to talk a little bit about all things spooky in film and television and horror movies and sharing a little bit about some of our favorites. And we are also welcoming students back to campus who started arriving late last month. So we will be reserving a part of our time to talk about what is on their minds, and that is sex and other things. But for the purposes of today's conversation, sex.
Yes, indeed. So when talking about scary movies, though, one of my favorite all-time scary movies is the movie Scream, for a number of reasons. One being, it was during the time that I was actually in high school, so I felt a kinship to the cast.
The thing too, it was educational. I'm watching this horror movie,
but I'm learning so much about the genre of horror movies, or at least an aspect of certain horror movies that were created. And there were rules that were given in a scene, right? The basic ways to survive any horror film. You can never have sex. You can never drink or do drugs. And of course, never, ever, ever say, I'll be right back.
You know,
you can never
say, you will not come back.
You can never say those things. Mm-hmm. And so when looking at horror movies, for the most part, you know, those rules do apply. But we'll get into more like the sex component. Like, you can never, ever have sex.
Horror movies as enforcing moral standards. Yes. It's real. So Scream, coming out in the 90s, has held up pretty well in the last 20 plus years. I was really impressed. I didn't see that until I was an adult, because we did not watch horror movies in my family until I was like 18. So I watched it later in life, and I had heard that it was a really smart satirical. And I was like, ugh, it's not going to be that good. It was made in the mid-90s. But it was,
like most things made like in the 90s.
You know, nothing good. Well, except our students, some of them, right? No. Those folks already flew the coop. Okay, well, we love you, mid-90s. You're fine. So I was really surprised the first time I saw Scream. I thought it was very clever. I thought it was really good. And particularly in offering that kind of satirical critique of movies that came before, yeah, right, in the 80s and 70s. So true. And one of my favorites is similar in that kind of self-awareness, and that's Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah,
which was so
Joss Whedon
played a part in that. Yes. And which, if you are a fan of Joss Whedon, you will recognize many of the actors, because he reuses, like many directors do, like gets this favorite set of people, and then they are in everything that he is connected to.
Pretty much.
So I, as somebody who likes much of what he does, although he is one of those complicated public figures,
to say the least.
Yeah, really enjoyed Cabin in the Woods. I liked how they brought a different spin. Oh, it's hard to do this without spoilers. A different spin on examining the tropes.
Yes.
Right? Examining the tropes and taking, I think this is all in the preview, so I can say this, taking like five college kids who start out in the movie not necessarily stereotypes, like they're kind of well-rounded. But then, like, in order to serve the plot purposes, the movie has a contrivance to, like, make them into the stereotypes needed for a horror movie. And it's just fun. I mean, it's just fun because it invites us to, as we're watching these movies, be thinking critically about what we're looking for in the movie.
True.
How are we looking for this movie to serve us? And what are the vehicles by which horror usually delivers whatever that is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It expounds the universe that Wes Craven, who did Scream, and of course Nightmare on Elm Street, who he expounds on that story, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we have this meta narrative going on. Like, the audience is too smart for just
hey, you know, let me the slash usual. It. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do we create this world within a world that winks at the audience? Like, you think you know what's coming up, but then we're gonna put a spin on that. And that's super enjoyable. That's another mm-hmm. one that I really enjoy. My scariest movie, like Scream wasn't scary. I like it's a thrill. It definitely is a thrill. But my scariest movie of all time is Exorcist. Exorcist.
Don't make me talk about that.
That movie gets me. Like that mm-hmm. movie I have only seen once. Mm-hmm. Lights on, middle of the day. I think I was still by myself. So I had, you know, I was a bit brave in that. But demonic possession, I don't mess with that. I mean, you could say, oh, you're being superstitious, you're a baby. I don't care.
I'm not gonna say that to you, Terrell.
I mean, not you specifically, but like you generally and broadly. Yeah. It gets me. Yeah. Like that whole it could happen. Mm-hmm. And even people do believe that, you know, it does happen. Not like it could happen, but it's based upon real events.
Horror does like to make those claims. I think they're not all legit. I don't know about The Exorcist specifically, but it's been really fun to notice how many horror movies are like based in semi-related to real things that might or might not have happened. Because it's part of how they suck you in,
that's
right?
How they draw you in, yeah. Like paranormal, yeah. Right? Isn't that the whole
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, the Paranormal Activity stuff. Yeah, I have not successfully watched Exorcist.
Successfully.
In the sense that when I was in high school, we had a watch party and I may have been under a bed sheet for months, like plugging my ears, singing to myself. It's like, did the movie end? No. All right, I'm going back to my thing here.
That might have happened.
That might, you know. There were witnesses who may or may not choose to come forward. Yeah, scary. I think that the first time, I don't remember how old I would have been when I saw The Sixth Sense. I know it's not scary, but
No judgment.
This is a safe space.
Safe space.
I would have been relatively young when it came out, I think. Maybe also in high school. Not a good time for me, honestly. I really was so disturbed by the scene where this, I feel free to relatively spoil because it's been out a really long time. There's a scene where they drag Cole, this kid, into a closet, like these mean people at a birthday party.
Oh yeah.
And like horrible, like unmentioned things happened to him in that closet. It was really upsetting for me. And then the later scene with the little girl under the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a lot. And where she like comes into his red tent and like vomits. Oh gosh, there was a lot going on there. Evidently vomit is where I draw the line.
A lot of triggers for you.
That's terrifying. I don't, you know, and then as an adult, like there's lots of things that I notice. There's a big difference for me between scary and gross. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things that I choose not to watch again because they were gruesome and gross. Mm-hmm. Or like the level of body horror was like not my cup of tea.
Oh my goodness.
I don't do body horror very well.
So you didn't see The Centipede?
I did not. That is a movie I just know I will never watch because it's not my thing.
I had to watch it because it was on South Park and I was like, I need to see what movie they're referencing.
Yeah.
And then I saw it and I was like, my Lord.
I cannot unsee that. That's what I hear from people. It's like there's certain things you watch and then you can't unwatch them.
No.
So if somebody says that about something, I will not watch it. I'm like, I can't. Otherwise, I have this lovely forgetting experience.
This amnesic property principle,
it
something.
Works well.
That works out. It works well. Yeah. So what was the worst horror movie that you've ever seen?
Like quality wise?
Quality, content, enjoyment factor.
Gosh, the worst horror movie I've ever seen. Do you have one?
Okay,
you go first. You go first.
Okay, so for me, It Follows. The movie It Follows is really one that I'll say the worst because of all the expectation and hype that was built around it. It has such a great buzz, and I was really looking forward to like getting a good shock, a good scare, or at least going like, huh, all right, that did it. All right, and then keep the lights on tonight. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen. And having it being explained away as like more of a social commentary or more of an intellectual kind of horror movie. And it's like, well, I'm not stupid, but you know, like Scream, right? Scream was intellectual. Cabin in the Woods was intellectual within mm-hmm. the genre. So mm-hmm. there are movies. Horror movies can be social commentary. Yeah. So yeah. as I'm now giving you time, like
my favorite social commentary movie.
We can talk about that okay. after you talk about your worst.
All right. The reason I have difficulty with this is because I came of age in the time where like YouTube started doing, you could like skip the movie and just watch the explanation of the movie. Mm-hmm. So I have managed to avoid a lot of movies that I've had to like sate curiosity about without seeing by going to these cheater videos. However, and I don't even remember the name of it. It was in college. Someone was like, oh, I really like this horror movie, and was based on a video game. And it was this perfect example for me, as neither a fan of the video game nor ultimately the movie, of that intersection of misogyny between video games and horror films, which both can have real serious misogyny issues, mm-hmm. That this movie was just rife with it for me. Of like, I felt like I was watching a movie that as a woman, I was like, this is like not healthy for me. Like, this is not healthy for anybody. Why are we watching this?
Are you going to tell us what?
I literally don't remember.
Oh, that's how bad it was.
What happened?
The title of the movie?
I don't know. Something. I want to say maybe Silent Hill. Is that a video game?
I don't know that Silent Hill is a video game, but it's definitely a movie.
Maybe not. I don't know, y'all.
I thought you were going to say Resident Evil.
No. But, you know, in that genre, there was mm-hmm. just, it was like, as we're watching it, I'm looking around at the other people watching it with me. I'm like, am I living on a different planet? Like, are we just not seeing the same movie? This movie hates women. Like, it doesn't even maybe know that, but it does. And I think horror, part of my difficulty mm-hmm. with my love for the horror genre, aside from like, I don't love body horror. I don't love torture porn. I mean, there's a lot of subgenres within horror True. That I can't get into. Is that I think even with relatively surface level feminist aspirations, a lot of horror is pretty misogynist and like hasn't fully unearthed that shadow side. I think contemporary horror does a better job. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously far more diverse directors and writers than we used to have for mm-hmm. horror. And mm-hmm. so we're seeing some, especially in those social commentary movies that are starting to come out.
Yeah.
Some better, but like Stephen King stuff is a little hard for me.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
He, for as dearly as he is beloved, like, and I get like Carrie is an example where he fronted a female, you know, protagonist. So that's charming, but like usually he's got a shtick. And like when it came out, and so people were resurfacing like the connections between the book and the movie.
Oh, that book is horrid.
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty depraved.
There may have been some writing errors, right? Of like, you should not probably have chosen to put that in your book.
That book was disturbing. That book was definitely like, what am I reading?
Right.
Oh my goodness, this is borderline a lot of things.
It's murky, right? There are some real gems. There are some real, like you said, that the intellectual, and I'm not like saying there's no value in horror that is not also, right, intellectual or social commentary, but it's generally not for me. I don't find a lot of value in.
Yeah. Social commentary, there was, I don't know that it was an article, but it was definitely looking at why the zombie genre had like just ballooned, just mm-hmm. like boom, mm-hmm. especially with Walking Dead. Like that really just kind of unearthed or rebirth the genre in a sense. And then of course people were looking at, well, Night of the Living Dead, the one that pretty mm-hmm. much started it in the sense of how we see a zombie now. There's a disease that unearthed them and no one really knows why they're
a lot of disease above, origin.
Above ground.
Yeah.
The social commentary was more how bleak people were perceiving that era. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of times when zombie movies do come back up, it's because the social consciousness is pretty bleak and in a sense of hopelessness. What does it say that people are seeking to identify or watch movies, horror movies, as kind of a catharsis or way of emoting or a mm-hmm. way of seeing whatever trauma they're experiencing being played out. Yeah. And like during a pandemic.
One of my favorite film analysts who focuses on horror and thrillers on YouTube was talking about, since the pandemic has come up and she's been collecting recommendation requests, right? What people are looking for VOD and, you know, what can I watch? And she said a surprising number of your requests are like, I want something really depressing and disturbing. And she said, I was really surprised to see this because I feel like we're surrounded by depressing and disturbing. Like, why would you be seeking that out in mm-hmm. your escape? And that's where we come back to that symbolic catharsis that you were talking about, right? Is that not being a film analyst or critic myself, right? I have no film background.
That's fine.
That's fine.
A lot of people aren't, and they still have
channels. We all pretend like we're experts. It's cool. of what, especially as you're talking about the different genres, sub-genres of horror, of like zombies or vampires or werewolves or Frankenface.
Oh, my.
Face, whatever, right? Like Frankenface. That's not a huge genre. But all of the body part assemblage, right? Yeah. Each of those subgenres has a more specific fear that is being explored mm-hmm. that you can look at, you know, like, what is it about zombies? What is it about vampires? What is it about werewolves? What is it about creature features, right? Like, where there are more specific layers that we're exploring of what we're afraid of, what we need to confront. Mm-hmm. And part of what I like, I mean, it's not as common anymore, but the thing about the final girl trope, right, mm-hmm. which will lead us back around to sex in a moment, is that there was always a survivor. Like, you could count on somebody mm-hmm. who could be your viewer vehicle, right? Like your mm-hmm. surrogate in the movie to make it out. And so you get to come out triumphant on the end. There's a note of hopefulness. Even once I started throwing in that, like, gotcha scene at the end where you're like, you think she's safe, but blah, here's a thingamabob.
She got right? grabbed.
Which you're like, whatever. For the sake of the movie, I'm assuming, right, that she's fine because that's what I need as an audience.
She lived. She lived. She's good.
Fine. She's great. She's not traumatized. No, she's going to live a
beautiful
life.
That limb doesn't matter. It really doesn't.
No one needs that.
No one needs it. It's an extra appendage.
So, yeah, I think that that's the piece that I have really, like, what draws me into it, right, is that what are we looking for? What do we need from this? Because most people, not all people, do enjoy watching a scary movie once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I understand that there's a divergence of opinion about whether that's quote unquote good for us, right? Of like, what is the limit of what's quote unquote good for us?
Yeah.
That benefits us to engage and what is harmful to engage or what makes us overly desensitized or violent or what have you.
Yeah.
And so this is where I'm like, I'm gonna tap out on that conversation because I'm not an expert, right? But yeah. I think it's interesting to engage. Coming back to that with this critic being like, why do you want to see such depressing, horrible things? Why would you want that? We're living that. But within the context of living that, we are forced to make decisions. Decisions that require amount of processing that are difficult to make. And the thing about horror of the old days with the rules that you were citing from Scream, right? Yeah. And like Randy's rules of order, that feels like it should be a thing instead of Robert's rules of order, like Randy's rules of horror order.
Yes.
The moralistic, I don't even know whether to call it an overtone or undertone, right? Of these films of like the virginal.
It's probably
good girl.
More like undertone because I don't know that people would have picked up on that.
Probably not.
That's why I guess Randy explicitly says the rules because right. It's like he's slashing because they're there, you know, right. But you're not seeing, oh, but they were doing this and they were doing that and they were doing that. Like it right. just seems like they were innocent victims or bystanders.
Right.
Or
in a single movie, there's no pattern, right? It's really yeah. only until you start to see the horror genre build that you're like, wait a minute, I'm noticing a trope.
Yeah, there it is.
There it is. And that's where I think there's just been this interesting analysis of horror as perhaps much more so in the early days being sort of a moral enforcer mm-hmm. in the subtext of we reward these people and these people can survive and then these naughty teens over here who are having sex and engaging with substances, they will die.
Yes.
And that's how we do that.
The sex component mm-hmm. and in COVID and people are asking themselves about, well, how do I do sex in the middle of a pandemic? And you know, there are many sides about that. There's the church side that typically says don't.
Unless you're married.
But you think about, how do you answer that question? And some people have.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, the connection is kind of back to that moral behavior being rewarded mm-hmm. and quote unquote, like deviant behavior being punished. Mm-hmm. Is I feel like pandemics work a little bit like horror movies if you construe it that way, mm-hmm. right? If you think about, we were talking earlier about the way that AIDS was used against people and particularly gay men as mm-hmm. like a weaponized, like this is happening to you because of your sexual choices. Mm-hmm. Rather than separating out the science from the negative bias and yeah. the like bigotry associated around like with homophobia, which has continued into our time, but was really rife at that time. And I think about the students that I know who are facing questions like this. I think part of what complicates or muddies the conversation is the moralistic overtone attached to conversation about sex at all, where I think what I would consider most helpful in a context of pandemic is that more sexual health angle when we talk to anybody who is considering being sexually active about how to be a caretaker for your own health and safety and those of your partners. That's a conversation both about consent. It's a conversation about clear communication. It's a conversation about being able to add a layer of maturity to sexual relationship that involves accountability and saying that if for me in my sexual choices, want to make sure that I feel safe and respected with the person with whom I have sex. And that requires clear communication about what consent looks like, mm-hmm. And what context consensual sex is possible and when I would say it is not, mm-hmm. as well as our understandings about how limited our sexual activity is to, say, this context with one another, mm-hmm. or is my sex partner also having sex with a bunch of other people and didn't consider that to be my business, right? I mean, so there's yeah. lots of layers of being sure to ask up for the information that's important to you. There are a lot of students who are in committed relationships with somebody where there's an understanding that that's like, I've heard of a lot of different language for this, like a germicule or a pod, or there's some sort of like established relationship mm-hmm. where we know we are a risk of COVID infection to one another mm-hmm. because we're maskless or exchanging bodily fluids or whatever's going on. But we're enhancing the security and reducing risk in every other area mm-hmm. so that this relationship is as safe as possible.
Yeah.
Right. So the risk is really, really high between the two of us, but we have ratcheted down risk of exposure in every other arena mm-hmm. to make sure that our high risk to one another doesn't really become as considerable a concern as it could be. Yeah. I think most challenging during a time of COVID would be engaging in a series of multiple relationships with different partners mm-hmm. because those are not going to be as contained or safe, protected from the virus, right, as mm-hmm. they would be otherwise. Because this isn't sexually transmitted in a primary way, this is transmitted through, you know, the air, right? The droplets in the air, it could be aerosolized. There's all these pieces that it's like, there is no safe sex with COVID.
No.
Like, they're just...
Unless it's with self.
Unless, oh, that's right. Yes. Do you want to talk about your resource?
This is through Oregon Department of Human Services, and it's their Oregon coronavirus update. Of course, on a lot of the students' minds is, well, how can I get some?
Just that way. Now I'm here and I'm ready to get some.
They have this bit about back to college. What about intimacy? First bullet point is the best way to prevent COVID-19 is to avoid close physical contact, right? So this includes kissing, sex, and any other acts where you're likely to exchange bodily fluid. And then the second bullet point, it states, the safest person to have sex with is yourself. And it's like, okay.
That is always true.
It can't.
Even outside of a pandemic.
In a pandemic, outside of a pandemic. That's like, right. You're your safest partner. That being the case, hey, go for it.
Well, this is where I realized this was your worst horror movie, Tarilyn.
Yes.
I think part of the popularity of It Follows was because it speaks directly to people's fears about sex. feared negative ramifications, whether that's specifically STIs or being sort of unceremoniously abandoned or feeling used or kind of all these things where, I mean, talk about exploring what we're afraid of in horror films, right? It's like, to me, that might be one of the most direct links. And as I think about trying to support people and making discernment and discerning around their sexual choices during a time of COVID, is one like to try as best as we can to wipe away all of this kind of moral, like you're good if you don't, you're bad if you do. And again, just strip it down to what helps you feel like you are respectful of yourself and other people. And how can you make choices that honor your sexuality and your sexual needs in a way that are the most affirming and respectful of you and other people? And what I think I hear that is distressing to me is mostly the misconceptions about how COVID spreads, or like the things that people maybe sort of halfway realize that that's how COVID spreads, but then halfway don't realize, like, well, maybe if we just wore masks while we had sex, and it's like, that literally will not help, right? I mean, those are the pieces, right? Where it's just to say, like, I want to support you making good choices. That's not how it works. And unless we have these conversations. Mm-hmm. And before COVID, I felt this way about a lot of factors related to the decision to make sex, particularly in a context like college, right? Where it's like, I don't want to have these conversations to tell you whether you're good or bad based on your choices, or like whether you've done something that like you deserve bad consequences because you made that choice. I remember when I was in college and I was let me see if I can remember this. I was on.
You remember being in college?
I do, but this is an acronym. I was on the sexual assault peer education team, SAPET. Okay. And I remember when we'd give presentations in front of college classes, and part of the presentation was talking about substances and intoxication and trying to help people understand that regardless of how you feel about consent for sex when you're intoxicated or someone else is intoxicated, the law is this, right? Yes. Like the law is that is statutory rape or rape, because we do not consider intoxicated people legally to be able to provide consent. Mm-hmm. And people went ballistic, particularly men, right? Who like got really upset and defensive. And that's what makes me sad, is I wish there were ways to have conversations about like, if you want to get drunk and have sex, you can figure out a way to do that safely, right? Like, and you and your partner need to recognize that legally, that situation is not consensual sex. And you might want to talk about that, right? Like, these are conversations that are important to have. So in the pandemic context, it's only much more so, right? The clarity of communication. Before my first sexual relationship, my poor partner, right? Like, we literally talked about abortion. I was like, I need to know how you feel about this topic, right? I need you to know whether we are, like, at least theoretically in the same space around this, theoretically in a different space around this. I recognize that we're using protection, but like that does not guarantee that a pregnancy will not occur. And I don't want to have this conversation for the first time on the other side of that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's talk about all the things that we think are important before we make this decision.
You've mentioned it a lot where you say, talk about what is and isn't comfortable, what is and isn't okay. You're being okay with your own sexuality. What does that mean to be okay with your sexuality? The other person's sexuality, how do you respect that person in this act? So any final thoughts?
My only, as you were speaking, Terilyn, the only other thing that came to me.
Oh, so this is what you were thinking about as I was talking. Okay,
no, because of what you were saying, I could quote back everything you said.
Sure.
Was remembering college being a time where there was also a lot of pressure around sex. And I know this sounds like such a typical, I don't know, mom/gym teacher thing to be like, don't let the kids pressure you, kids. Like,
it's true.
But it's also true. And especially as you were saying about talking about things that you're comfortable with and not comfortable with, is I have just been either in or next to so many situations where that's not received. Like, if someone tells you they're not comfortable with something, leave it alone. Mm-hmm. Like, stop pushing them. Stop being like, well, we'll change that by doing it, right? Or like, you just need to learn it. You know, like, just this more than any other time is about respecting what people tell you about their boundaries and their limits and saying like, and this goes beyond sex, right? This is the whole COVID negotiation right now. When we go out to see friends and they say, hey, I'd love to see you, but I want to be masked and outside. That's where we kind of have to say, instead of being like, well, that's stupid or overly cautious, being like, I would love to see you too. And if that's how you're comfortable, let's do that. As we're learning to respect one another's boundaries and what makes one another safe, I hope that extends into, for our students, the conversations they're having around sex, right? Is when somebody says, this is what I'm comfortable with, this is what I'd like to do, this is what I'd like to try, this is something that is off the table for me.
Yeah.
That we get really, really good and practiced at being like, I hear you, I respect you, that sounds great.
Yeah. Those are great final words. The group that we're featuring for this podcast is called Two Button Brass. The song you'll hear is Children of Sanchez by Chuck Mangione. That's arranged by this brass quintet. So thank you for tuning in with us. I'm Carolyn Lawson.
I'm Claire Joseph Meyer.
Thank you.